a movement session, a speed training session, Rob, should tell a story. And what I mean by telling a story is the things that you say to athletes are going to layer context that is going to build, is going to set them up for success. You know what you want them to do at the end, and you're giving cues leading them up to that application. But not just what you say, but also the drills that you select.
Welcome to the Pacey Performance Podcast, the podcast that dives into the philosophies, ideas, and practices of some of the best practitioners in high-performance sport. On this episode of the Pacey Performance Podcast, we have three guys from Exos. So we've got Brent Calloway, Anthony Hobgood, and Nick Hill. So we kick off this episode with Brent, Anthony, and Nick giving us some unique insights into what the Exos methodology actually is. We have a deep dive into Xavier Worthy's 40-yard dash from a few weeks ago, the record-breaking one. Then we have a look at some overrated and overhyped aspects of speed training, and then also some underused and underhyped aspects of speed training. So a really interesting episode, which gives some incredible insights about Exos and how they do things and how they build top class athletes. So a really interesting episode coming up. This episode of the Pacey Performance Podcast is sponsored by Vald. So I'm really proud to have Vald as a sponsor again. And after a recent visit to Vald HQ in Brisbane for their annual Valdcon event, it's incredible to see how far they've come as a company since I last visited at the start of 2018. So from a very humble office of less than 20 employees back then, it's amazing to see how far they've come. They now employ a global team of more than 200 that support clients across 100 countries, including many of the world's elite and professional sporting organizations. So an incredible rise to where they are now. So this is a huge testament to just the impact they're having across the industry with their innovation, but also continued commitment to support clients. So if you're a performance practitioner, you probably know all about Vald, but if not, I'd recommend that you check them out at valdperformance.com. This episode is also sponsored by TeamBuilder. TeamBuilder is a software for performance coaches around the world. The powerhouse platform increases efficiency, saves paper, and can handle any type of programming. It's the perfect fit for professional and academy teams, performance institutes, schools, and universities. TeamBuilder is full of tools that help coaches' needs. Multiple max tracking methods, 16 plus reports, evaluation testing, and goal setting, just to name a few. Coaches also have access to consultations with TeamBuilder's in-house sports scientist to help manage and analyze data. Head to teambuilder.com and sign up with promo code SPORTSMITH to start your 30-day free trial. So without further ado, over to the episode with Brent, Anthony, and Nick. Brent, Nick, Anthony, welcome to the Pacey Performance Podcast. Thank you for carving out a little bit of time in your diary to join me.
Thank you, Rob.
Thanks, Rob.
Yeah, appreciate you having us.
No, thank you very much. Thank you very much for coordinating it and making it happen so quickly. So I'm going to come to you, Brent, first. We're going to have a 2 or 3 minute bio, and then we're going to dive into the topics that we've discussed around speed training. So Brent, give us a quick 2 minute bio.
Yeah, you bet. Brent Calloway, I'm the Vice President of Performance at Exos, and I started with this company in 2008 as a performance manager after working for Velocity Sports Performance, which is where I worked for Lauren Seagrave for a while and had the benefit of being able to learn from him. And then prior to that was a collegiate track and field athlete at the University of North Carolina. But since then have moved into this role where my job is delivering our product firsthand and being able to work with our athletes and in human movement and human performance and helping to tie all of the departments together and across all of our facilities and then managing the practitioners that we have across those facilities as well.
Nice, mate. Decent athlete?
Yeah, I like to think so. Rob, I was a pole vaulter.
Okay, oh, nice. Wow.
So, yeah, pole vaulter at the University of North Carolina with a 5:41 PR. So I sneak in there like a decent.
Good, good. Like it. Nick, over to you, mate.
Nicholas Hill. I am a pro elite performance specialist in Arizona at our headquarters facility. I started with the company in 2016, actually under Brent Calloway. I did a internship with him in our Carlsbad site and then went out to Arizona right after the internship and have been out there ever since. I work with all levels of populations, primarily with the pro elite population right now. I oversee our combine program in Arizona and then our NFL vet program, some NBA programs. So just kind of full spectrum, kind of working with pro elite populations and yeah. Also decent athlete, I would say. Kind of like, yeah, I would say I'd like to think above average, but probably more closer to average. I played college football, junior college, and then D2 ball out in New Mexico.
Nice, nice. Beat that, Anthony. We've got to get a good athlete on this call because I certainly fit in the average or below average.
I wish.
You saved the right one.
My name is Anthony Hobgood. I'm the senior director of performance at Exos. I'm also a former college athlete. I played college football. And finishing my college football career, I actually came here to Exos in 2007, which I think this May would be about 17 years ago. I was a grad student and worked in a biomechanics research lab and kind of volunteered at Exos at first. And then I transitioned to a part-time coaching position while I was finishing grad school. And then upon finishing grad school, moved into a full-time role in 2009 and worked with the gamut of athletes here at our facility, you know, high school, college, professional. We also do a lot of military, so working with the United States military personnel as well. And then I've been one of the lead coaches on the NFL Combine program since 2012 here at our facility. And my current role, I'm still coaching NFL Combine. I coach when I need to here in the facility, and I'm also managing the staff and the performance product, if you will, across our 10 locations.
Nice. I think you might be, well, you're probably all well-versed in this. Obviously, you work for the company, but give us an idea of the structure of the facilities, because you three guys are in three different places. You've got athletes in all three, like, and 10 by the sounds of it. Anthony, give us a bit of an idea of what Exos looks like these days.
Yeah, so what I tell people, when they walk into our doors, they're going to see a team of professionals. We have performance specialists, we have physical therapists, we have dietitians on staff, and we have operations staff. And we are all surrounding the athlete to take care of them. And so whatever their goals are, if they're coming in and they're recovering from an injury, trying to get back to full speed, or if they're coming in for the off season, trying to maintain a performance, or they're preparing for some event where they need peak performance, regardless of where their goals are, we as a team are going to surround you and help you achieve that. And that's really the simplest way to put it.
That's right. And Rob, just to add on to that, we've at this point, our company has grown to 11 locations that we're working through. We handle a lot of offsite projects as well, but we've got 11 brick and mortar locations that we're working through, with the three of those that we represent on this call being the ones that are the most pro athlete facing. So that's how they tend to break up. The other facilities that we have are full service facilities as well, and typically have lots of local market, youth population, adult population, et cetera, inside of those. But that's where Exos has grown a lot in the last several years. And we also have a very large corporate wellness presence and tactical military presence and things of that sort as well.
Has there ever been any flirting with the international facility?
Yeah, we've actually looked at it a few times. And what we end up doing is working with either teams or Olympic development organizations and operating out of their spaces, but just working with, you know, with their athletes that they have on hand rather than it being a commercial business. So we've gone that direction.
Understood. Right. Let's dive in. So all about speed training. So when it's discussed, when speed training is discussed, the very common comment, just nail the fundamentals. So Brent, talk us through what your idea of the fundamentals actually is.
That's a good one. It's a good one to start on. And you'll get a lot out of these guys when it comes to nailing the fundamentals. You know, for us, when it comes down to pure speed training, it's a unique situation because we obviously have athletes that play primarily multi-directional sports that have to access speed for being on field. And in you know, an instance like an NFL combine program, they're actually speed tested by a third party, which is a unique setting as well. So when it comes down to nailing the fundamentals, you know, we always fall back to the combination of stride length and stride frequency and being able to manipulate those variables as needed in order to yield the athlete's result that you need to, and being able to have that athlete produce a big amount of power in a short amount of time through the proper direction and an optimal range of motion, you know. And so I'll always go back to that one. It was one of the first things that Lauren Seagrave taught me in probably 2003. And so that's been, you know, the overarching theme for myself. When I'm looking at what we're going to underpin and how we're going to start to build out our structure, it comes back to those things.
Anything to add, Tane?
I look at it, I kind of look at it, you know, just contributing to what Brent just said. You got two buckets that you're dealing with, okay? You have your running efficiency, which is your technique, and then you have the amount of force you can generate and the rate at which you can express that force. And so everything that you're doing to improve speed is manipulating one of those two variables. So when you think about like in the weight room, going through your warm-ups, if you're working on certain mobility, right, of certain sections of the body, you're going through certain speed drills, everything there is really essentially dealing with efficiency. So if I generate a lot of power, a lot of force, am I expressing it in the way that's beneficial for my speed? Then the other bucket there is going to be force application and a rate of it. So whether you're in a weight room working on strength development, or you're doing plyometrics, or you're working high-speed running, you know, where you're actually in a competitive environment and you're sprinting full speed, that's dealing with a bucket of, you know, force application. So that's kind of how I look at it, just those two buckets.
Don't have to add anything, Nick, if you don't need to.
No, I mean, I can't say it better than they did. I just think it's a unique perspective when you're looking at the athletes that we're working with. So when you're talking about different speed fundamentals, you're usually talking about pulling from the track and field world. And we're pulling from not just multi-directional athletes, but athletes of all different sizes. I mean, I have an offensive tackle that just left for pro day that's 350 pounds and he's 6'5". So it's the way that you coach it is very unique. And I think that's one of the unique things about this combine program is you have the speed fundamentals and you're focusing on acceleration and different positions and patterns, but you're also doing it with a wide variety of different athletes. And you're all preparing for essentially the same test. You're preparing for running 40 yards. And it doesn't matter if you're 350 pounds or if you're 165 pounds like Xavier Worthy. So it's a unique coaching problem to solve every year, which is fun from athlete to athlete.
That is a very true point Nick just made. Like having to translate what you know. Like if you have a track and field background and you're very well versed in speed development, well, being able to get that translated to American football players is a whole nother set of problems to deal with.
Is that something that you guys see as a flaw of that of the industry pulling on track and the team sport S&C side of the industry pulling so much from the track and field that people get lost in that translation piece?
I think that to start with, in the world of Division I university strength conditioning in the United States, they do a fantastic job. The coaches that are existing in that space and grinding in that space are amazing coaches and amazing practitioners. And they have great teams around them of people from sports medicine to physios and everything that's included inside of that. At the same time, they are preparing them to play a football game and to win games. And so they have to weigh all of their programming against that. What's going to get us more wins? And so that's understood, right? And when they come to a situation like we have, step one for us is to solve the problems that they have when they walk through the door. And typically after playing a 14-game season in college football, most of them have injuries that they've been battling too. You know, they've been in war for several months, and it's time to heal up. So we have to be able to start implementing the mechanical strategies and the things that we're teaching while we're also starting to clear up injury, which is not always easy. You know, it depends on the severity of the injury, depends on the type of injury that the athlete has that they walk through the doors with. But when it comes down to it, we have to start implementing the strategies and manipulating those variables that are going to give them the biggest speed gains that they can get in actually a very short amount of time, which is usually somewhere around 6 or 8 weeks. So it's a different exposure to the athletes. And I think that these guys can speak to this really well too. But also when you're taking athletes who are truly novice sprinters and asking them to execute new mechanics through new added ranges of motion at new velocities, joint velocities and field velocities, you're opening the door to more potential injury, right? So we have to navigate that in a very effective way and find the sweet spot for all of them. There's a lot of load management strategies that come into play there as well, and a lot of communication that you need with your team. But I think just to go back to your question, Rob, the athletes that we get when they come in their door, they're having to transition their mindset from playing a sport and winning at a sport to either preparing themselves in the off season for that sport to start again, or go to a testing event where they have to go through an evaluation process. And those are different mindsets that you have to go through, you know? So it's a shift for sure.
Anthony, I'm going to go back to one of the points that you made earlier, technique versus the physical quality and pulling the strings on each one of them, depending on which one's needed. But how do we know which one's needed? What's your process that you guys go through?
Well, I think there's a couple things. One, when you bring someone through our sports science testing and you have them jump on force plates, you're able to get a force profile of what's kind of under the hood of, like, what kind of engine do they have? How much power do they generate relative to their body weight? So if you see somebody who generates a lot of power relative to their body mass, then there's a lot of potential there that you could tap into to run fast. So if somebody's not running very fast and you see they generate a lot of power relative to their body weight, you know that we might see some upside here. And the other piece is when they're actually running, there's some common, I would say, technical flaws that you see show up when you're going through your drills, as you're going through all the acceleration drills, the absolute speed drills, as you actually are running. You can see all the efficiencies that are just the inefficiencies glaring at you right in the face. And so it's a combination of both of those. So if you look at their force profile, you can see kind of potential, but then also you can see where the inefficiencies are exposing when they take off. Like, for example, day one, when the guys line up on a 3-point stance to run, almost all of them have a very, very, very inefficient 3-point stance. So what that means is they have to, when they decide to go, there's a lot of movement that has to take place before they actually leave the line. So they're not starting in the right positions. They have poor angles. There's a lot of pre-ignition movements, if you will, that will absolutely rob them of a lot of time. So I'd say a combination of your eye as a coach, you see the inefficiencies, and then looking at our data that shows up, you're able to kind of paint a picture of where's the biggest upside for this person. You know, and then we're going to be trying to manipulate both of those. It just depends upon how much potential there is in each one based on where they start.
Coming to you next, Nick. I've just realized, Nick or Nicholas?
Either way, yeah, Nick is fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Perfect. Yeah. Perfect. Should have cleared that up 16 and a half minutes ago, but here we are. You mentioned about dealing with the big guys. I'd love to get a couple of examples or one example of exactly what differs when it comes to these fundamentals, when you're dealing with, like, the example that you just mentioned, the big guys.
Yeah, I think the biggest one is volume. You need to be able to control volume with the big guys. They're not built to sprint 3 times a week for 20 yards, 15 yards, you know, back half running 50 yards. So you just need to be able to control volume with them. A lot of the mechanics in the beginning and kind of the teaching concepts and coaching cues are going to be similar to the rest of the athletes. This is a reactive sport, so every position is reacting to another person on the field. So most of them want to pop up vertically within their first couple of steps and have their eyes up because they're used to reacting to something. So that's going to be the same cue that I use with a 170-pound wide receiver is stay down, drive, keep your eyes down in your first 10 yards. I'll use that same cue for a 350-pound O lineman. So it's less of the cueing. It's less of the even the coaching specifics, especially in the first few weeks. And I think the biggest one is just controlling volume. And they will not only get beat up a little sooner, but, you know, that week four, they start aching a little bit more. The times start dropping a little bit. They're not built to be running that fast that often. So you just need to be very aware of we have to get quality work in and we have to get the job done that we're there to do, but you have to be able to do it in a minimal effective dose with them.
Is there any other athlete or buckets of athletes where that also may be the case? Not just the big guys, where volume needs, you need to be cautious with volume.
Yeah. I mean, really everybody, you have to be cautious of volume with all of the guys. Even the skill guys, you know, they're still not trained. And they don't have the tissue tolerance, and you have to be careful with building up the tissue tolerance and very specific with what you're adding in each week. And the guys are also super competitive. And so if they don't run fast on the first rep or the second rep or the third rep, they'll start to get very competitive with each other a lot of the time and want to do a fourth and a fifth and a sixth and a seventh rep. And you have to explain to them that this isn't necessarily a do more, get faster kind of situation. More work does not necessarily equal faster results. And coming from football, coming from American football, that's kind of the culture is I have to work more. I have to do more. I have to outwork the person next to me. And so trying to educate them early on in quality over quantity is super important, and making sure that you're getting really good quality reps when we are full speed or full gas or even in the warm-ups, making sure that everything is clean and crisp. You want to get your work in and be efficient within the sessions and the windows that we have for them. Because if you're going and doing extra work outside of the training facility or you're trying to add in extra reps, it could be to your detriment. It could actually end up hurting you if you don't have the proper amount of time or the right amount of time to recover.
You're right. If I can add something in there with Nick too, Rob, the one thing that he said that's absolutely true is tissue tolerance. I think when most of us as practitioners and strength conditioning coaches or speed coaches start to process mentally, how am I going to improve an athlete's speed? You know, the qualities that you're looking at and the programming that you would instill to do that all have to be brought into the top of your mind in order to figure out if this is the right thing for this particular athlete, right? So like when Nick says tissue tolerance, I think of some of those larger athletes that we were talking about and RSI. You know, we would absolutely want to increase an athlete's RSI if we want them to run faster. The way you're going to increase RSI is going to be through foot strength and plyometrics, extensive and intensive plyometrics, and that type of accumulation. And when you have athletes that weigh 300 to 325 pounds, 350 pounds, you have to be very careful about how you start to accumulate those loads. And again, going back to injury history as well, because short time frame, we have to make this big gain in speed. Sometimes 3 or 4 tenths of a second is what's expected in a 40-yard dash in 6 to 7 weeks. So we have to implement everything that we can in a safe way. And so when you start to load in plyometrics with an offensive or a defensive lineman that has that type of weight to them and mass to them, there's a lot that the lower leg and the foot goes through. So we have to absolutely modify lots of exercises in relatively large group scenarios, you know, groups of 10, 12, somewhere around there on most occasions. With all types of athletes and in different injury situations and physical situations. So, I think Nick was right on with tissue tolerance and then being able to guide those effectively and help make those correct exercise choices and volumetric choices as well while you're taking the athlete through that group scenario.
I'll ask you this one, next one, Brent, because we're here anyway, but I'll come to Anthony and Nick because they'll definitely be able to weigh in. When it comes to the fundamentals, is there anything that you commonly see that is misunderstood, is classed as a fundamental part of what you guys do when it's actually the tear on the cake? Is there anything that comes to mind when I say that?
Yeah, I think the when you're looking at the mechanical model of sprinting, I think that there are a number of ways that that could be slanted depending on the athlete that you have, right? So most of the athletes that we get, even down into the high school age athletes that we're working with now, have had some type of technical education on sprinting. Now, that technical model that that has been implemented with them doesn't always account for the shape and structure of their body. And sometimes it's like a one size fit all model, which isn't 100% the case when you're trying to get big speed gains on a short time frame. We would obviously like to get everybody into a technical model that visually represents who we are, both as a company and as practitioners and coaches. But at the same time, that model doesn't fit every athlete. Just due to restrictions and the way that they play the game, the movement biases that they have, et cetera. So when it comes to that piece, we always start at a fundamental level of teaching speed context, right? So the athlete needs to know what positions to get into. And we work through a hierarchy of position, pattern, power, where we'll start with simple fundamentals and the athlete learning which positions to establish and step one, two, three, four, all the way down into maximum velocity sprinting, which we term absolute speed sprinting. And to be able to understand those positions so that then we can then load them effectively and train them both in resisted and assisted situations where the athlete can then take that mechanical teaching, be it on, wall drills or heavy sled pushes or something of that sort, where we can repeat the correct positions and slowly implement the pattern work with that, to where we take that across the spectrum into high velocity sprinting and into an applied scenario. I think that the athletes have all been exposed to those context driven drills. But when it comes to implementing them at 100% effort is where I start to see the mechanics break down. Team sports, in my opinion, usually lives somewhere around 85 to 90% efforts. It's like in the game of American football, you have to survive to live to the next play. And so how many times am I going to give a bout of 5 to 6 second 100% intensity? And that's not very common because I've got 40 seconds and then the next play is going to start again. But what we're trying to do when we have an athlete that's going to go to the NFL combine or a pro day, in order to be exposed to the NFL and for those scouts to be able to see what an athlete can do, they have to learn what 100% effort is. So to go back to your initial question of, are there any areas that they might not have been exposed to in the past? I think that they've been in survival mode for a long time. And when you're trying to trigger 100% intensity, there's an education process that has to go through and exposure process as well. That has to go through that. The athlete does, anyhow, to learn what that is.
Lots of nodding going on there, Anthony. Do you want to weigh in? Anything to add? Just unmute.
You're muted.
Unmute.
Sorry about that.
Back to COVID days there, aren't we?
Just to make sure I understand your question again, could you rephrase your question just so I can make sure I answer it?
Of course. Yeah. So it was the... what is classed as fundamentals for you guys? Is there anything that you see other people do which they may think these are the fundamentals and spend a lot of time on them, where actually that's the cherry on the cake, or that's like an extra over and above the fundamentals that they shouldn't be spending as much time on because it's not the core of making people fast?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't see a lot of other people doing speed training. But I would say that sometimes,
or you in the past, maybe, I don't know,
that what I see people using drills that are not relevant to the qualities needed for that aspect of sprinting. So as an example, if you're looking at running at top speeds, okay, you want to have a very, very high frequency. Okay, with your leg action is a very high frequency with very short ground contact times. Okay, you don't want to spend a lot of time on the ground. The longer you're spending in contact with the ground, the slower you're going to be running at top speeds. So you'll see somebody running at top speeds, like pulling a heavy sled or running with a parachute behind them or doing things that is altering their posture and increasing their ground contact time at top speeds. And that's actually that's contraindicating to the actual what you need to be developing at top speeds. And then the same thing for on the front half, at the beginning of a sprint for acceleration. Acceleration requires a little bit longer ground contact time and aggressive angles. And so if I'm doing drills that are reinforcing more of a higher frequency on acceleration and a shorter ground contact time, well, then that's not really training acceleration. And so this is why I think that, you know, one of the prerequisites, I believe, to being a really, really good speed and strength coach is having a very basic, like, understanding of physics and biomechanics. Because essentially what you're dealing with is we're dealing with a human body is mass that's having to move in relation to the atmosphere and gravity, right? And so anytime you're going to accelerate or decelerate, if your velocity isn't changing, it requires angles. So if you imagine if you're standing vertical, not moving, you're tall. As soon as you start to walk, you lean, right? You have to create an angle to begin to change your velocity. Well, the faster you're accelerating, the more lean necessary, right? So walking is a very slight lean to begin moving. If you're going to start to run, more aggressive lean. If you're sprinting, like if you're going to run a 4-4-2-1 like Xavier did, super aggressive angles, right? So angles are relative to the ability that you to move your mass relative to gravity and the degree at which you're accelerating. And so one of the common things you see, I would say one of the most common things that you see with athletes when it comes to acceleration is they tend to have a very cyclic action versus a very like piston-like pushing action. And so one of the things I think probably 95% of our athletes all need to improve upon is their first two pushes off of a line is to have the angles, the leg action in a way that maximizes angles and leverage for acceleration and then not going into a cyclic action on their first two steps. So there's more we can get into on all those things, but there's a lot of like common things. I mean, cycling to accelerate is probably number one. On the top end speed is when posture breaks down. Well, if your posture begins to break down, your hips get back behind your shoulders. If your posture breaks down on top end speed, you begin to get long on the backside of your leg action. And when you get long on the backside, you lose knee drive. And when you lose knee drive, you begin to reach. And so you see this posture breaking down, long on backside, low knee drive, and I start contacting the ground out in front of my center of mass. And anytime you contact the ground in front of your center of mass, that is how you decelerate. So if you're running and want to stop, you got to put your feet in front of you to stop. And so athletes who are very inefficient on the top end, you will see their form begin to break down and just watch where they're contacting, and they'll start contacting out in front of them. And it's essentially they're taking a deceleration step every time that their foot hits the ground. And so I would say those are kind of the two primary things that you see as far as technical inefficiencies with the start, acceleration, and top end speed.
So we're just going to take a very quick break in the chat with Anthony, Brent, and Nick. So over in part two, we have a little chat around the overhyped and overused aspects of speed training, but also the underused and underhyped aspects of speed training. So really interesting part two coming up. This episode of the Pace of Performance podcast is sponsored by Vald. So I'm really proud to have Vald as a sponsor again, and after a recent visit to Vald HQ in Brisbane for their annual ValdCon event, it's incredible to see how far they've come as a company since I last visited at the start of 2018. So from a very humble office of less than 20 employees back then, it's amazing to see how far they've come. They now employ a global team of more than 200 that support clients across 100 countries, including many of the world's elite and professional sporting organisations. So an incredible rise to where they are now. So this is a huge testament to just the impact they're having across the industry with their innovation, but also continued commitment to support clients. So if you're a performance practitioner, you probably know all about Vald, but if not, I'd recommend that you check them out at valdperformance.com. This episode is also sponsored by TeamBuilder. Team Builder is a software for performance coaches around the world. The powerhouse platform increases efficiency, saves paper, and can handle any type of programming. It's a perfect fit for professional and academy teams, performance institutes, schools, and universities. Team Builder is full of tools that help coaches' needs. Multiple max tracking methods, 16 plus reports, evaluation testing, and goal setting, just to name a few. Coaches also have access to consultations with Team Builder's in-house sports scientist to help manage and analyze data. Head to teambuilder.com and sign up with promo code SPORTSMITH to start your 30-day free trial. And now back to the episode with Brent, Nick, and Anthony.
Just to kind of piggyback off of that quick story, the importance of those, basically what Anthony's talking about is those first three steps, what he was mentioning. When Xavier Worthy ran the first one, his first three steps weren't great, and he still ran 4.25. And so I knew when he called me in between, and he said, you know, I'm keeping the cleats on, I'm not hanging them up, I want the record. And I said, okay, well, you have to get it in those first three steps we had been talking about. You have to do it in the start. If you're going to beat John Ross, you have to do it in the start. And the night before when we were in the Exo suite, he was doing the starts that we needed to hit. And so I've seen him do it. And I knew on the first one that that wasn't it, but he still ran 4.25. So he goes out on the second rep, and the first two, three steps, I knew he would get the record. So you can see, and we've seen the guys do it so many times, and we know when it's a good rep, and we know when they do that, the start, and they hit their angles, and they have that low sweeping drive, and they have that piston action with those first three steps. And so I knew the first three steps just from him coming out that he was going to hit the 4.21 on that second one. And it's just that you can see it immediately. You know the difference of the efficiency and the power that they're putting through the ground, and then their ability to get up to top end speed and run the back half. So that was just quick kind of bounce off story from how that would relate to actually when you're watching the guys do it. You can see it. You can see the difference.
Yeah, Rob, if I can add on there, just at my own athleticism, when I was watching Xavier run at the NFL Combine, I was about 15 to 20 feet behind Nick while this is happening. There's a row of chairs, and I'm having a conversation with the NFL strength conditioning coach. And when I saw Xavier get down in his stance again, I paused the conversation. After his first two steps, I leapt over both sets of chairs that were in between Nick and myself. And I quickly closed the gap, all right, between myself and him. Because when you see somebody leave a line like that, you know something's about to be special, you know. And so Nick did an awesome job in articulating that to the athlete and him being able to take it and put it in play immediately thereafter. But my own athleticism was the thing that nobody saw. And so I just wanted to speak to that.
Absolutely. Taking the average to above average.
There you go.
Yeah. Very modest. But these guys don't know their time straight away, do they? Do they call you for the
After time? The first one, they don't. The second okay. one, they've started putting it up on the Jumbotron. And so when okay. Worthy ran it, or you see a lot of the guys when they run it after the second one, they look up. It's because they're getting the live feed that we're watching on TV. So he got the same 4.22 unofficial feed. And then it came back about 30 minutes later for the 4.21 official.
So why aren't they able to see it after the first one? What's the rationale?
I'm not sure. Yeah. That'd okay. be a NFL combine question on that one.
Another one.
Yeah.
Okay, that's cool. Right, translating speed into from practice to in-game speed. I think we've maybe touched on this a little bit, but obviously different for your scenario, Nick, when you've got a clear aim, like whether that translates to what goes on in later in the year, like that's not your thing at this moment in time. But what are you putting anything in place to be able to create that foundation to be able to do that? Or is that just...
Yeah, no, absolutely. Okay. No, it is for sure. And I talked to the guys about it. You know, this isn't just preparing you for this 40-yard test in 8 weeks. I mean, you're learning to be more efficient in acceleration. You're learning to be more efficient at top-end speed. You're educating yourself in sprinting. So the only difference is you're not going to be in a three-point stance, especially when you're talking about, you know, receivers. It's you're coming out of a 2 point, but acceleration is acceleration. And we prepare guys. I have my NFL offseason guys in right now that are going through very similar, training sessions, just not as focused on getting in your 3 point. And a lot of those guys come back. I have Deebo Samuel in the building right now, who was one of my combine guys, I guess, 2019. So 5 years ago, 6 years, whatever that was. And his big focus is he wants to get faster again. He wants to feel as fast as he did at combine. And a lot of the guys will come back, you know, the next season or a couple seasons later, and they say, this was the best experience I had. This is the best I've felt, and the fastest I've felt, and I want to get back to that. And so
that's a good feeling for you.
Yeah, no, it's great. And I mean, the program itself is amazing because, and I don't want to go off on too much of a tangent, but even talking about BC talking about RSI, improving RSI, and Anthony talking about athletes' ability to get into angles. It's the combine program is amazing because it's not just us. It's not just the speed training. And it's not just the weight room. It's all inclusive. It's the controlling as many variables as we can in this 8 week program, from nutrition. We have our dietitians, and we're doing DEXA scans when the guys get in, so we can look at the full body composition of an athlete and try to get that body composition down. Because if you want to get an athlete faster, make them less fat. I mean, that's honestly that's one of the best tools that we can have. And we have a kitchen on site in Arizona, or if we don't have a kitchen on site, we're bringing in meals that are going to be specific to those athletes. We have our physical therapists that can either be reactive or proactive from injuries that they had coming out of college, or keeping them healthy because they're going to get beat up throughout the process. So it's just this all-inclusive process where we can control as many variables as possible, from the speed training to the position coaches that we bring in, to the meals that they're eating, to the supplements that they're getting. And when you can control as many of those variables as possible, that's when you're going to squeeze out as much juice of the process out of the process. And so that's what these guys come back, and that's what they love about Exos, is we have all of that under one roof. We're not contracting physical therapists in. These are physical therapists that work with us year round. And so we're all speaking the same language. Our dietitian is working with us year round. She's a part of the facility. So when we have a problem to solve with 40, 45, 50 athletes in a facility, and each one has a unique situation that we need to solve for, we're able to do that because we're working together year round. It's not just I just met the dietitian, and we kind of have different ideas of how to solve problems and our own little egos in there and whatnot. It's almost like an egoless kind of situation. Like we are very confident in our ability to deliver the results, but we also know that this is a team thing, and it's not just about Nick Hill, the speed coach, or Brent Calloway, the speed coach, or Anthony Hogwood. We know that we lean on our dietitians and physical therapists and strength coaches and people working the front desk and everybody behind the scenes that's helping us build the schedule and keep us organized. That's what helps the guys get better. So it's not just the quote unquote speed work, which is the flashy stuff that everybody wants to talk about and know about. But the reality is, it's everybody around. And I don't even want to say the supporting staff, because it's not really, it kind of takes away from the importance of it. I mean, it's a one team kind of a thing. So yeah, tangent right there. But, that's how we're able to deliver the results that we deliver. And that's what the guys come back for. So that's what the Deebo Samuels DK Metcalf or any of the guys that have kind of come through the program, that's what they come back for, because they feel so supported while they're here. And that's why they feel great in Indianapolis or at Pro Day, because we've taken care of all those things. So they don't really need to think, you just come in and you put the work in and they can just focus on the task at hand. They don't need to worry about, hey, I need a massage therapist, can this and that. We have it all set up. It's all right there for you.
Nick, I think Brent, you've mentioned it as well, maybe Anthony, it was the process when an athlete first comes to you, so you can understand what they need, what they don't, DEXA scans, etc. Would you mind taking us through, and I'll put it out there, whoever wants to take it, that, take us through that process, why it's in there in the first place, what that information is actually telling you. That'd be great if you possibly could. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. So I'll run you through the process real quick, and I can get long-winded here, so I'll try to keep it brief. But the athlete comes in, initially fills out an injury survey. So we look at their existing injury and injury history. And then from there, they go meet with our dietitian. So the dietitian takes a DEXA scan. And then she's also collecting about 30 different anthropometric results. And those measurements help us determine an athlete's muscle-to-bone ratio, which is probably another awesome podcast conversation that we could dive into. But we've been able to work with Francis Hallway out of Argentina and Aaron Wellman, who's now with the New York Giants again. And in over the last 4 or 5 years, really starting to understand optimal muscle-to-bone ratios and then how to adapt athletes off of that. So we get that information. The dietitian also takes a food log for a food recall for the athletes and starts to guide them down the right process as far as weight loss, weight gain, maintain program for them to initially start how we handle their off season or a program like the NFL Combine. But whenever they enter, we would get that info. They would go from there to meet with our physical therapist, and the physical therapist will take them through our own assessment, which we call a pillar prerequisite assessment, which is a combination of SFMA and several other things. There are some objective measurements that we get. We want to, as coaches, we like to know full ranges of motion, like what's the range of motion capacity through all the primary joints for that athlete. So we catch ankle dorsiflexion, we catch hip internal and external rotation, flexion and extension, then thoracic spine rotation, and shoulder flexion. And all of that information then goes into, we're currently using Kittman Labs, our dashboard system, for us to be able to go back and look at our whole roster of athletes that we have and figure out who has the deficit where and how might that be impeding the movement results that we're seeing on the field and how those movements are realized. So just gives our coaches and practitioners a lot of context around why that athlete moves the way that they do. And then our physical therapists also diagnose a movement bias in there if an athlete has one. So if you have an athlete who biases flexion or systemic flexion, which we call a global movement theme, or if you see them bias extension, then that is noted as well. And that also helps us to program very effectively. From there, the athlete goes over to our sports science area, and they go through force plate testing. We do squat jump, counter movement jump. We do single leg hop, and then pogo RSI. And then after that, we would measure posterior chain strength with Nordboard. And then we take a hip abduction, adduction assessment with force frame. So we're using VALD tools and the sports science section. That all feeds through the API and our dashboard as well. So at the end of the day, a coach like Nick or myself or Anthony can sit down, pull their entire group up, and without even seeing them move, can actually start to derive a lot of context around why the athlete moves the way that they do, and start to build that technical model of what that athlete exhibits when you go out to see them run. So that's what our evaluation process looks like. And then from there, we will bucket athletes into different categories so that we can start to solve those problems on more of a little bit more of a local scale, and being able to say, okay, which athletes have force absorption deficit issues? Well, let's start to cater their programming toward that. Or which ones have, an RSI issue? Well, we can give them exercises specifically for balance and start to inlay those modules as well. And there are a couple of other categories we work through there too. But all of that leads to decisions that we're making in the training program itself, the protocol that we execute. And then, I keep going back to context, and just the more information that you have about an athlete as a coach starts to tell you why they move the way that they move, and if you see that you have an athlete who biases frequency over power, and then you look in and can see that they have, a hip extension issue. Maybe they've got a limitation there. And so, you know, anterior chain is short, hip flexors are short, whatever the case is. Now you know where I can target in order to start to solve the issue that I'm seeing out on the field when they start to move.
Perfect. Excellent. Right. We've got two final points, and I get excited with these kind of questions. I fucking love them. Overhyped aspects of speed training, and I'm going to come to you, Anthony. What are your thoughts around things that are overhyped in this area?
I would say too much time doing drills and not enough time doing sprinting, like a competitive environment. Like the absolute number one thing that needs to be present when you're if you want to get faster is running at max velocity. So getting in a competitive environment where you're timing somebody or you're racing somebody and actually exposing them to that. You cannot improve speed without actually running at max effort. So you see a lot of coaches will spend so much time, you know, doing drills, which are good, but drills not applied do not equal results. You got to apply it.
Anything else? Happy we go with one, and we'll circle through the guys.
I mean, that's a great one. Yeah, that's a really good one.
Yeah. Any additions, Nick? Any additions?
I mean, I think that's just to kind of piggyback off of that. It takes a really strong understanding of linear speed to create a 90-minute session of linear speed where the athlete is actually getting better in that, and it doesn't turn into just a bunch of drills to fill time. It doesn't turn into conditioning session because it's not meant to be a conditioning session. So it takes a lot of understanding around the fundamentals of how do we progress this session? How does each drill and anything in the movement prep, how does that build off of each other so that we're actually getting what we need to get done by the end of that 90-minute session? 90 minutes is a long time to be working with guys, and that can turn into, and I think you see it a lot on, you know, social media platforms, it just turns into a lot of either footwork or kind of wasted time with drills that aren't necessarily going to apply to the athlete getting faster. And if you have that strong understanding of, you know, what we're trying to get done, you can build into that and work through that training session properly. And that's kind of what the Exos system does for coaches. It kind of gives you that framework. And then as you get more and more experience and you kind of build up your resume with athletes and the guys you work with, you can start having your own little twists on things. But if you were to look at my speed session versus BC's speed session versus Anthony's acceleration session, they're going to look very, very similar because they're all based off of the Exos training system. And then we each have our own little unique flares that we've kind of, you know, personalities of coaching that we've kind of picked up along the way. But yeah, that system is solid and proven.
A movement session, a speed training session, Rob, should tell a story. What I mean by telling a story is the things that you say to athletes are going to layer context that is going to set them up for success. You know what you want them to do at the end, and you're giving cues leading them up to that application. But not just what you say, but also the drills that you select. And so if you were to just give you a simple summary of what a really good training session should look like, it's going to address positional requirements, it's going to address pattern requirements, and it's going to address power requirements. So think position, pattern, and power layered in that sequence. And so if you're working on acceleration that day, well, what are the positional requirements of the ankle, the hip, the T-spine, the arms? Like what does a body need to do? And then how do you address those things as you're warming up? And then as you go from the warm-up, what is the patterns needed to run efficiently? And then there's a coordination inside of my speed drills that I'm working on specific patterns needed. And then as I add in different, the next thing I do is then how do I now take the patterns and apply that with high force and velocity? And so all those things layer. It's like telling a story that's very seamless from the start to the finish. And so what you'll see sometimes, you'll see coaches using just a kind of just a different tool bag or different drills that aren't really connected and don't layer properly. And so if you layer it properly, you get better skill acquisition, the athletes understand it better, and ultimately you get better outcomes. They got to blend.
Love it, Anthony. Brent, overhyped.
Yes. All right. So I'm going to say this on the back end of just explaining what our eval process consists of. And I realize what this is going to make me sound like. But overhyped, I'm going to say spending money on tools, toys, and technology. You know, I just talked you through everything that we do, which has a lot of that in it. But at the end of the day, if you stripped all of those things away from the three coaches that are on these podcasts, I'm sure you're in the same boat, you could have a fantastic practice and a fantastic program with nothing, right? So you can give me a towel or an elastic band or a rope, right? And we can make a fantastic training protocol that's going to yield results. And it all comes back to the knowledge that's derived and the knowledge that is imposed on that program and in being able to put it in a systematic way, is what I should say, that can yield results. All of us have had to do that in the past. And I think all, you know, we would all say that's an effective way to do it. The tools that we use and the tech that we purchase give us more information. And that's very useful, but it's not a requirement. So, but if I'm going overhyped, it's breaking the bank on a lot of things that you don't necessarily have to have.
The cool part with again, kind of piggyback off that. The cool part with a lot of the tech that we've been using over the last 5-6 years is the way that we kind of look at it week to week is I will roll through my list of athletes and I will say, I bet that this guy has this, this, and this going on. And then we'll look at the sports science data and we'll say, oh, look, check, check, check. And it's exactly what we're already seeing. But where it's super helpful is when you get stuck on one or two guys and you're like, I can't figure this kid out. And then you can go and you can start to kind of layer in some of that sports science and kind of peel back the onion and say, oh, okay, he has, you know, he low RSI or whatever it is, we try and figure it out. So it helps us solve the problems faster when you're in this very short window. But a lot of the time it's just confirming what we've been seeing over and over, just as speed coaches out there.
So I was going to say, what you're saying, Brent, is break the bank on getting the next Nick and Anthony versus the tools and the tech. Give these guys more cash.
Yeah,
nice. Like it.
That's how you get better results. That's better practitioners. It. Yes.
underhyped aspects of speed training. Anthony, coming to you again.
Underhyped. So overhyped versus underhyped. Wait, is it overhyped I'm responsive to or underhyped?
We've done overhyped.
Underhyped.
Now we're at underhyped.
Plyometrics. Like plyometrics. Okay. If I had to choose between strength training, again, this is obviously like if you got a young athlete that's very, very weak, they need to have the strength to support the speed. Like if you don't have a base fundamental level of strength, then you have nothing under the hood of your car to go faster. However, if your baseline of strength is there, okay, then you forget the weight room. You could make tremendous changes in someone's field performance by utilizing plyometrics. So plyos are probably one of the, you know, I would say, you know, more underutilized tools at manipulating athletes' ability to produce force, to improve tissue tolerance, and not only improve force, but the rate at which they express that force and how they express it. So plyos, man, huge fan of plyometrics. Big fan of speed.
I would say that's underused and overused, depending on how you're looking at it. I think it's more so that it's plyometrics a lot of the time are misunderstood in how to, it's just the same way Anthony was talking about telling a story. Your plyometrics also have to tell a story. You have to be doing plyometrics with a certain intent. You can't just randomly throw a bunch of cool looking plyometrics in there. They have to serve a purpose. So yeah, I would say 100% agree. Under, but there's also the almost like the overutilization of quote unquote plyometrics. Like, are you actually doing plyometrics? Or are you just doing jumping for conditioning?
Jumping around.
Yeah, exactly.
Box so. Jump. No, yeah, we're not, I'm, not talking, we're not talking about box jump for time.
Yeah.
Anything over and above plyos, Nick? The
underhyped? I mean, I'm underhyped. I don't know. I mean, just for my own personal use, I love a good prowler sled, push sled. But that kind of translates to exactly what Anthony was saying, was if you already have the engine, and a lot of these guys already have the engine, then you don't necessarily, I don't want to say need the weight room, but the weight room doesn't have to be such a priority. You don't have to continue to put horsepower in. Is, go ahead. Yeah, it's basically, I'm saying is, you can get more out of spending your time, because time is what's super valuable in these programs, of me trying to sprint with the sled or do plyometrics versus trying to add 10 or 15 or 20 pounds to your trap bar max. So what are we going to spend our time on? I love a good prowler sled and the different variations of sled pushes that you can do. And then,
well, the weight room comes in, and Nick, I think you'll agree with this, well, the weight room becomes very valuable, Rob, is not so much that I need you to get stronger, but it's another opportunity to refine movement and improve range of motions and strength within those ranges. So you'll have athletes who, you know, you're trying to improve their linear speed, but then you ask them to do like a rear foot elevated split squat and they can't do it. Like, they struggle with like a lunge pattern, like just the basics of being able to hold posture and create the gap or hip separation by one hip extending and one hip flexing. And so I look at the weight room for guys who are already strong as a way to improve range of motion and movement patterns that translate to the field. And then foot and ankle, almost still.
Brent,
foot
anything
ankle.
You?
Sorry.
Oh.
Go ahead.
I'll go there.
Yeah,
with you.
Go on, Brent. Carry on.
I've got a short list, and foot and ankle's on there. So I would just to tag on what Anthony said. I underhyped not spending a little bit of time each training session to develop a more appropriate aligned foot, and with toe splay and good ankle and toe articulation, and making that foot stronger and the lower leg stronger. I absolutely think that that's underhyped. And again, I'm not going to build a training system around that point, but I would absolutely spend 4 to 5 minutes at the end of each session giving a couple of exercises that can be extensively accumulated to not impact the athlete very much, but can yield a big result over time from a foot health standpoint. When I started taking my athletes' shoes off and making them remove their socks so that I could see what their toes look like and the shape of their feet, I really started to understand some limitations that they had. So I would absolutely agree with Anthony on foot and ankle. Another one, I would say implementing fantastically programmed recovery strategies and not having to feel like you always have to tax the nervous system. I feel like it, strength and conditioning staffs and performance coaches always feel like we have to tax the nervous system, and that thing needs to heal up just like, you know, any other muscle group does. So we need to take appropriately programmed breaks and strategies that heal up the nervous system the same way that we tax the mechanical system.
Plenty of thumbs up coming from Anthony. Love that. Cool. Well, I think I've kept you three guys for long enough, and I'll let you get back to your two mornings and an afternoon. Is that what it is? Yeah, nice. So, Nick, if anyone wants to get in touch, follow you've got going on, where's the best place?
Instagram.
Cool.
At Nicholas_Hill. NICHOLAS_HILL.
Lovely. Anthony?
Email would be best for me. It's ahobgood@teamexos.com.
Lovely. Brent?
Yep. And I'm Instagram also. It's just at Brent Calloway.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for lining this up so quickly, jumping on, coordinating time zones and all that kind of nonsense that that is often hard, but with you three was pretty easy. So I really appreciate it. Look forward to keeping in touch. And thanks again.
Thanks for tuning in to episode 490 of the Pacey Performance Podcast. Big thanks to Brent, Anthony, and Nick for giving up their time and giving us a unique insight into how they do things over at Exos. Also, big thanks to Vald and Team Builder for sponsoring this episode today. The podcast could not be done in its current form without these guys, so I really do appreciate all their support. Big thanks to you for tuning in, and look forward to chatting to you next time.